listeners to Sounding Out's podcast series, an oral chronicle of sound and culture. Sounding Out remixes the everyday with theory, insight, and practice. To learn more, please visit us on the web at www.soundstudiesblog.com. Until then, stay tuned for today's episode.
On March 10, 2017, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and Native Nations led a march in prayer and action in Washington, D.C. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and Indigenous grassroots leaders called on allies across the United States and around the world to peacefully march on Washington. Similarly, there was the Women's March in January, where a rapidly growing number of Indigenous women and hundreds of thousands of women and men gathered together on January 21st on Washington, D.C., and across the country and across the world, standing together in solidarity for the protection of our rights, our safety, our health, and our families. The Women's March in January sent a message to the world that women's rights are human rights. Representation from Indigenous women at the march ensures that Indigenous voices are being heard. Indigenous resistance is nothing new. Indigenous resistance is over 500 years old, and there's a few things at play here in the reason why space is being occupied in these very felt ways. One is that the United States profits from genocide of Indigenous people and the occupation of lands. Occupation of lands is not just a written piece of American history that only exists in the past. Recently, thousands have taken to the streets and to rural sites of political occupation. Some might say that these recent acts, such as the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Women's March, have awakened these traces of history that never left. In this two-part podcast, I'm going to be focusing on sound and how sound is increasingly critical to our understanding of this historical moment through social media, how things are heard, how things get edited, and how song and prayer is audibly occupying space. To do this, I'm going to talk with Dr. Nancy Mithlow, who is Native American, Apache. And in the second part, I'm going to be talking with Tracy Rector, who is also a Native American and Seminole. Both conversations for this podcast are inspired by the sounds of the protesters themselves and the noises that are made by the prayer and the song and the minds of those who have taken to public space and to rural environments to confront and to object. And don't forget to join us again for the follow-up conversation with Tracy Rector, who is a filmmaker and media activist. For the first of this two-part podcast, I'm going to begin with Nancy Mithlow, who has just attended the Standing Rock and Native Nations March in Prayer and Action that was on March 10th in Washington, D.C.
Friday, March 10th, Washington, D.C., protest march. Here goes. I'm listening to the audio that, which is the long piece before we get to Lafayette Park, and I'll play a little bit of it now. But what's interesting to me is, like, the sound of people's personal conversations, and you know, they're talking to each other and they're saying things like, "Yeah, my daughter had, you know, twins." Oh, hold on. You know, twins and maternal or paternal, and someone's talking about, are you going to go catch up with Granny? Or, you know, like, there are all these, like, little pieces of conversation. And it's kind of like what you experience in any public space, you know, when you're on a bus or an airplane and you get unintentional conversations, and you're kind of just floating through them. But it's a little different because you've self-selected to be in the crowd with these folks.
Right.
You know, so it's not like an oddity that you're just trying to get somewhere. It's sort of like, okay, like, we've got enough in common that we're marching together in this crazy weather. You know, so you're experiencing this wave of people, but also you're experiencing, like, the world around you.
I love that idea. I mean, how, what you were talking about with this idea of the sounds coming in and out, in this sort of, like, you're almost a voyeur a little bit. You know, you get these snippets of people's lives. But I wonder if, rather than on an airplane, since you're in this more personalized space of being at that march and traveling to it, and you have all these commonalities, and people are running into old friends they haven't seen in a long time, perhaps, that you're sharing more personal things than you would with a stranger on a plane.
For myself, I tend to be fairly transparent all the time. And I kind of got, I'll just be really transparent, I kind of got trained to do this because I grew up with an alcoholic. And I was like the young kid that stayed up really late at night and just listened, you know, and I got a lot of great stories and I was just acclimated. And so, you know, then I became an anthropologist. And so I'm a professional listener, you know, and I had to, at one point after I had children, because it just got so exhausting to take everyone's stuff, that I had to start putting the blinders on, you know.
For a lot of people in my life, anyway, this is recent kind of protests or gatherings or protector things are like the first time people are attending them. So I wonder, that's one of my questions is, if you use Standing Rock as an example of, like, why now, right? Like, why Standing Rock? Why now? What is it about this particular movement that's drawing out so much from people emotionally and spiritually and even physically? Like, what is it about this particular movement? And just to kind of, to go off of that, is it the sort of the timing with the election, for the presidential elections? And then you have the kind of women's march and the women's rights things happening. So is it the time, you know, or are they kind of lending themselves to each other?
Those are great questions. So, you know, I grew up in a segregated South, you know, when there were still water fountains that said whites only. Mm-hmm. And it was just a very confusing time for me. So I was born in 1961 and spent, you know, most of my first 20 years, you know, in racially segregated areas. And my parents were both part of kind of the Great Society. My dad did disaster relief, and my mom was the, like, only white school teacher in the black school. We all went to private schools. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think I grew up always with this awareness of, you know, some form of looming crisis. You know, there were actually, like, the synagogue got bombed and crosses were burned. And, you know, when you grow up with that, you think it's normal. You naturalize it. You know, it was like there were hurricanes every spring. We had to hide under mattresses, and I just thought everyone did that. You know, I didn't realize that other people weren't, you know, having crosses burned in their front yard, you know, because when you're a child, you just naturalize all of that. So, you know, I didn't do any protests then, but, you know, when I look back at it, like, my parents were really activists in their own ways, working within institutions. So I tend to myself work within institutions. But I got, I did kind of a dropout thing in my early 20s and spent 10 years living on the land as a mountain mama hippie homesteader kind of type. And there were folks who definitely were engaging in direct action. And so when my older daughter was just a few months old, I took her to the Women Against Nuclear Power March in Washington, D.C. She was 6 months old. She was the youngest protester. Uh-huh. There. And, you know, I just felt kind of compelled to do something because you have this young child and all of a sudden, like, your world might be destroyed by a nuclear arms race, you know?
Right.
So I think for me, it's kind of sporadic and it has more to do with my own personal narrative, maybe, you know, because, like, now I'm a grandmother. And so, like, of course, Trump is disturbing. And, you know, the attack on women's rights is disturbing. And, you know, the attack on our environment, all these things are disturbing. But I think for me personally, like, I'm a grandmother. And so, you know, I feel like I'm there on behalf of my children and my children's children. Like, I really feel that role. So I don't know. I mean, I think for a lot of my students, you know, I'm working with traditional age college students, many of them did not vote. And, you know, many of them kind of even lack the language to think about engagement. And, you know, not all of them, because I teach race. I get students, you know, last fall there was a lot of action happening in Los Angeles. And, you know, some of my students were blocking interstates at night with a Black Lives Matter. And I thought that was, like, really powerful. But it seemed to be, like, a greater divide. Like, I don't sense that there's, like, one societal swell moving in a certain direction, even among a certain age group or economic background or socio, you know, racial background. You know, I think that there's just a lot of influences happening simultaneously. But, you know, to get to your question, like, why Standing Rock and why now? You know, I think one thing I track is when Native Americans are seen in real time and how they're seen in real time and how they're viewed. So, you know, I was surprised by, of course, there's, like, very little press about the action on March 10th, the Native Nations Rise March on Washington. But, you know, the ones that I did see from mainstream press all noted that it was nonviolent. Like, you know, there was no violence, you know. But some people were using terms like Native Nations storm the White House. You know, we were actually in a park, you know, across the street from the White House. I experienced the march as very subdued. So, you know, I think the way that people consume Natives, you know, just in terms of their visuality and their language, you know, there's a certain set of expectations, and that's always, like, very colorful and very exotic. You know, even the most progressive news outlets during the march would tend to go up to a male, you know, B, someone who's dressed in traditional regalia, you know, C, someone who's kind of, you know, mirroring and expressing, you know, kind of a one with the earth, you know, religious philosophy. And I'm not saying that any of that is bad or should be negated, but, you know, it was rarer to see, you know, news outlets engage just kind of the average Joe protester,
right?
Or the average Joanne protester. You know? So I don't know why now. I mean, some of it is that they just continue to fascinate people. you know, and they don't know what to make of it, and they're trying to like process it, and they have so little to go on, but it just seems really hip and cool. I mean, the election, I was watching the Young Turks, which I really relied upon for the occupation at Standing Rock for news to teach with. And I noticed that the main newscaster, Jordan, who I really like, was asking everyone the question about Trump. You know, Trump, I guess, had a quote where he said something along the lines of, I haven't heard anyone complain about Standing Rock Pipeline, you know, Dakota Access Pipeline. I haven't heard anyone. And so, you know, many people at the march were actually saying things like, well, Trump can hear us now. We're here, so Trump can hear us. But, you know, for me and for what I sensed happened once we had the public rally at the end of the march, it wasn't about speaking to Trump. You know, I mean, Trump is not really the issue. I think most people who are participating in a substantial way in the water protector movement are more interested in the broader issues of environmental degradation, you know, treaty right violations, you know, just open bias and hate crimes that happened, you know, the physical harm that came to the water protectors. And then this idea of decentralization, even away from Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock specifically, to talking about oil extraction nationally, you know, or even internationally, you know, our reliance upon fossil fuels as being unsustainable. So, you know, I felt like there's a kind of the movement is becoming like a little more dispersed. Some people would say divisive. I don't see it that way. I just see it as like a natural progression of awareness. The Women's March, I mean, it was kind of fascinating because I attended the Women's March in Los Angeles. And, you know, it was interesting. There was like a traditional age. When I say traditional age, I think I'm thinking like traditional college age in their 20s. You know, so a lot of, you know, young folks were climbing up to the top of the bus stops and climbing on top of parked cars and, you know, taking off their shirts. Women were topless and, you know, they were doing the call and response. And especially in front of City Hall, it was kind of like a youth audience over there. You know, for me, I was like, I think this is just therapeutic and that's fine. Like our society needs every so often to get together and to scream and yell and commune with each other. I think we're just like naturally really hungry for that. So, you know, I think that, you know, the DC march, there wasn't that same, like, you know, let's get nude and rock.
There was no one on the street lights topless.
No.
Was there as much screaming and yelling at the DC march than there was at the Washington or at the Women's March?
The DC march was really remarkable in some ways because, you know, we all got there and there was some confusion. I think there's so much press. Later on, when I looked at tape, I realized what was going on. The line couldn't move because there was so much press around the protesters. And what was fascinating, there was a large black snake that one of my Cherokee friends said had something to do with Jim Henson's puppetry in a grant that had gone to a Native organization. Mm-hmm. That was Jim Henson's daughter or something who had donated that. Mm-hmm. And it said, no consent, no pipeline. And it had, took like 8 or 10 people to move this through the crowd. Mm-hmm. And what happened at a really like poignant spot is that the snake, you know, the black snake, started working its way through the crowd and saying, follow the black snake to the White House, follow the black snake to the White House. And it had, the puppetry had kind of the effect of calming and dispersing a little bit.
How were they getting that sound out of the snake?
They weren't. There was no bullhorn. There was no, it was just, you know, them working their way through the crowd and just talking to people as they worked through.
Okay.
You know, just saying, follow us to the White House. And by then, you know, we had like another mile to go and the weather was starting to let up.
You were talking about earlier the call and response, which is has been a big part of what we think of as protests, right? It's this kind of the special relationship that sound has to a protest. That's the cadence of the call and response patterns. The patterns of call and response, I think, are very, they're useful to get that frequency going that you're talking, that you were referring to in the movement of the protest. You know, it heightens your energy. It gives you that unity feeling, you know, where you're all kind of in this together and you get to yell. And I was just wondering if that's a more of a mainstream sort of protest action, or if that happens at like native specific sites also.
Yeah, I always think of when people say call and response that they're thinking about African and African-American spirituality, you know, in kind of like a Christian setting.
Okay.
Like that's my association with call and response.
Okay.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there's ways that you can kind of theorize that, about political actions. Is there like a larger Native connection, or is that a Western thing? It's a great question. You know, our Native nations, of course, are so dispersed, 567 plus federally recognized, hundreds and hundreds of unrecognized. And, you know, but I typically think about that relationship, just because I'm from Oklahoma, like with Creeks and Choctaws, that kind of call and response thing.
Mm-hmm.
In our culture, the men are the singers, and there's a component that happens during ceremony where the women have this action where you cover your mouth with your hand and you make this long kind of low sound, and it signals is I agree. I'm in agreement with you. I'm in agreement. And there's only certain times during the song rounds where you actually do that. And, you know, because I'm still, after all this time, fairly a novice in my traditional ways. So I have to follow the older women when they know how to do that sound. It's like a long, lull kind of sound. So I think every tribe is kind of different.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. It creates camaraderie.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to go back to something you said a little earlier about being in Washington and being heard, with just a really simple question of who, in your experience, like who hears it, you know? So it's just kind of like I guess when you're writing an essay or something and you have to do like the so what component, you know, like tell me why I should care. Who hears it? Is it, just to step back for a minute, there is, I don't think it's an argument, but there is statements, right? That even from Native people, I've heard it too, this kind of like, what's the point attitude, you know? And so I've heard people saying that about the protests, particularly with Standing Rock and the Women's March and everything else, is like, what's the point? Why are they doing this? So like, why do you do it? And who hears you?
No. I think, what's the point? I mean, I come at political action from, and even what I do professionally in terms of curation or art, is that we all have a different role to play. You know, even working at IAIA, right, Tribal College, Institute of American Indian Arts, I would have students that would really challenge me, like, why are we having to learn all this white man kind of, you know, language and theory? And, you know, my response is usually like, you don't have to, but for some reason you're in this classroom with me. And if it's not meaningful, you're welcome to leave, right? But, you know, this is a particular way that you can participate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a power, like language is power. And you know, I tend to think that it's not so much the audience that you have, but it's kind of internal transformation. There's something that does happen with, I really truly believe in embodied knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a daughter who has a speech disability, and if she's asked to sit still in a chair and perform verbally, it's very difficult for her. And if she can stand up and move around and communicate, it's very easy for her.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we have disassociated ourselves from the full complexity and holism of our human body, which includes our voice,
right.
And it's, you know, our legs, you know, it includes sights, sounds, and smells, and being with a group of people. Like, I really do think that that's a form of knowledge, and that when you enact that together, that you are changed, and in many ways, you're changed by the experience. and that experiential knowledge and that experiential learning is becoming more and more kind of a facet of higher education. That people are, you know, advocating that, you know, in traditional college settings, that the idea of sitting in a classroom is no longer going to be the way people learn in another generation. You know, that it's more you actually enacting something. So, you know, I think what's the point is self-transformation as much as transformation of another group. There was at a critical point in the DC march where there was a young man who was just very angry and was shouting and like, what's this all about? We need to be over there in front of Congress. Like, this is all bullshit. No one's going to listen to you. You're supposed to be over here. And, you know, people were kind of tolerating him, but it was a moment in which Native women were taking the stage and singing this very beautiful, I think they were from Akwesasne, beautiful, poignant song. And here's this guy in the back who's saying, like, this isn't the point, you know, the point's somewhere else. Again, it's like, well, then go somewhere else, you know. Mm-hmm. So everyone has a role to play. I am concerned, though, and I think this is what your question gets to, is that we're not necessarily engaging in meaningful, transformative communication with people who think differently from us. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's difficult to even do in a college classroom. Mm-hmm. It's triply difficult to do out in the streets when there's a lot of emotion at stake, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was concerned just because I can't afford, you know, time or money to be arrested. But I was concerned in front of the Trump Towers, like, you know, what if they militarize us like they militarized the water protectors? You know, is that going to happen at any moment? And it didn't. But, you know, I think that the ability to create opportunities where people can have a call and response in terms of communication, we lack those. We lack those settings. Like, my feeling is that we're economically kind of more dispersed than ever. You know, people who can afford to go to shopping malls and hang out and feel like they've had an experience because they've had an economic transaction, you know, mm-hmm. with other people. People who can't afford that, maybe they're on the bus, you know, and they have that communitas because they're all going to work together in the morning, or right. You know, but I think that something needs to shift in our public consciousness, because that we are becoming I think more hateful in our speech and actions. You know, I think somehow I think it's not even somehow, it's our current political leadership that is, you know, relying upon violent, hateful rhetoric. And I think it's like really completely a dangerous time to live in. So will protest marches create that kind of conversation? I think they created that kind of conversation with people who were in the offices up above, right? People who were stopped in traffic, you know, the people who watched us go by, it was sort of a moment of, oh, wow, there's a bunch of Indians out there, you know. And someone might say, I am imagining, like, I have an Indian friend, or I heard an Indian song, or I have a silver bracelet from Gallup, you know. Mm-hmm. What do you think? I mean, does it make a difference?
I think it makes a difference. I mean, I agree with the same kind of sentiment that you're talking about, where I think because I didn't go to any of the Dakota Access Pipeline or anything like that, I can't. With the Women's March, it was this sort of, as you said, I think it's coming from this position of being a mother, where all of a sudden I felt compelled to attend. These are difficult times to explain to children, you know, like the protest, that happened in the airport while in Seattle, that was unexpected. That was a really difficult thing to explain to a 4-year-old. And you know, I think children are pretty resilient and can go, for the most part, just kind of go through the day without really caring or knowing what's going on around them. But that doesn't mean that they're not hearing it, or that people aren't treating them differently at school based on what their parents say. I just think kids are like I think the times we're living in right now are very scary, and racially charged. I think America has always been racially charged from its inception, But I think for going back to why does it matter, I think it matters because it brings an awareness. And not being involved in Dakota Access myself, I like to watch and I like to hear the awareness that it's brought to mainstream society. Mm-hmm. That, you know, we are seeing Indians on the news, we're hearing them about it on NPR. And not that that really validates anything or makes something real, or, you know, but.
Well, it does in some ways. I mean, because when I look at museums, I was at the Getty today, right? Mm-hmm. So much money, so much prestige, so many great brains, and there's no representation, right, mm-hmm. of Native anything. Or if it is, it's something always, like I think one of the speakers talked about a Native American petroglyph, right? But there's no like kind of connection with contemporary Native realities. You know, in the arts world, I'm always really frustrated by that marginalization or the simplification. Like the levels of knowledge are so low that they're just like really embarrassing, and it's harder and harder for me to have like meaningful conversations with people. Mm-hmm. There was one protester who's getting interviewed in D.C. who said the reason why we're not going to be covered is we're not violent. And he said, this is not a violent movement. You know, we're a prayerful people. You know, we're not the type of people that want to, you know, burn things or set fire to things or, you know, mm-hmm. hit someone. Like we're praying. Like this is a spiritual endeavor. And he was like, and that doesn't get press. But, right. You know, I think there's something to that, but I also think that there's like a much, much deeper, like really schizophrenic, you know, I always like to quote Vine Deloria Jr. about how America's schizophrenic because they will not accept that America was built upon basically the appropriation of land and resources of Native people. And I actually like Dave Archimbault's, some of his early interviews where he was saying, like, you know, we have always been giving. We've been giving since, you know, you came here, and we have to stop now. Like, there's no more for us to give you. Which I thought was like pretty effective in terms of just kind of, you know, rhetoric. So yeah, like how do you make that? Is it public protest where you're in the public eye? Is it through having the right degrees? Is it political office? You know, how do you get that voice?
Yeah, I think just that the also why it's important is just showing those acts of resistance.
You know, I always look at those like, well, I can use those in a classroom, but then,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I realize, you know, the classroom, and whenever I open up a class, I'm like, you guys are luckier than 99% of the world because you get to sit here and talk about ideas. You know, it's a very elitist kind of endeavor. I mean, our education's becoming not a right, but, you know, privilege for the privileged few. So
yeah, absolutely.
But you know, you actually, again, to go back to the embodied thing, like, you know, your work, you engage people, they're bodily performing in front of the camera, you know, in an interview setting, or, you know, like you're taping their voice, you know, and there's a power that comes with that level of just documentation. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, the Chuck Daly wisdom, mm-hmm. which I always struggled with, right, was that, you know, you won't see the impact of this for another two generations, you know, and I tend to always, like, I want more. I'm not that patient.
Mm-hmm. So I guess in closing, just to close out the conversation from about the protest in Washington, when you think back on it, what could you explain, like, what, you know, a lot of times we ask each other, well, what was it like? And then we kind of defer back to visuals. Well, there was a lot of people, everyone was wearing turquoise. You know, I think that's our society. And I also think it's our kind of natural default because we rely so much on visuals for transferring of knowledge and information and signals and symbols. But I guess I would want to challenge people more, and if they say, what was it like, instead of deferring to the visual, what was it like, and then defer to the sonic or the sound. So if you remember the march, the last one in Washington, how would you describe it the way it sounded?
That's really a good question. You know, I think for me, what I enjoyed was that there wasn't just one audio. There were layers of competing audio constantly. Mm-hmm. You know, there is the conversation that you're having with the person that you come with. And then there's a conversation that someone next to you is having. And, you know, and then further on, like, you can hear drumming happening ahead of you. And so it gives you like some kind of anticipation, some kind of hope. And then you can hear these ground swells of cries of joy, you know, behind you, you know, people, you know, welling up, and it gets carried through the line. And it made me think about, again, when I'm in my tribal community, there was a feast that we had where there was a huge storm, and I didn't witness it, but at one point there were two lightning bolts that hit each other.
Wow.
Above our ceremonial fire, and it made this huge like crack. And right afterwards, there was this culmination from, you know, it was about 200 or 300 people, this culmination of this human voice, and it was totally joyful. It was so joyful. It was just like this uprising of voices, just in elation, right? Like, we're one with the power. Like, we asked for that and we got it, you know, just like the most joyful communal sound ever. And that really stayed with me. That was like, what, 10 years ago, maybe almost. And I was really, I think, heartened in DC because I was reminded of that, you know, like we could be downtrodden. We could be mournful. You know, there's a lot to cry about. I go to too many funerals. You know, there's just a lot of opportunity for us to be in that negative state of mind. And I think if I think about the audio in general, it was this sort of a joyful sense, right, of being together.
Right.
And this joyful sense of like we're sharing something together, and the way that it moved in waves in front and then behind you was just really powerful. It, you know, it's that feeling of belonging that I think that we all really long for.
It's a really beautiful explanation. It's so fascinating to me that we explain the sound, but automatically default, I can picture it visually just in your description of the sound. You know, you could hear it, but it's, you know, it like goes along with this sort of visual imagination of it.
But I think we're in an age that prioritizes the visual.
Absolutely.
You know,
because
we're always looking at the screen, looking at a pad, we're always looking. Mm-hmm. And I think that we just have failed to kind of adequately think through our audio. Like we are used to, I don't know, in Los Angeles, you know, my guy came to visit and he was really disturbed by the helicopters. He just the whole time was just like, oh my gosh, how do you live with those helicopters overhead all the time? And, you know, I found myself just saying like, roll up the windows and turn on the radio. Gosh, you know,
block out all the noise.
Just get over it. You know, oh, yeah. But I think we do like block out all the noise. You know, we live in a world, well, like right now, I don't know if you can hear.
Yeah. Sirens.
Yeah. You know, we live in a world where we just have a chaos of sounds. So, yeah, maybe that's kind of our last frontier, is to be attuned to what's coming at us through our ears.
hun. So do they think they tell people, like, stay away from the windows or something?
Maybe, yeah.
Does he think he'd want to watch this, though? I mean, I would.
Oh, I just came for tonight. I'm solo, man.